Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and it has been a pretty big week in the old cybers. We'll be talking about Exchangerpalooza 21 shortly, and I honestly don't know whether to laugh or cry, but we'll get to that in a minute. This week's show is brought to you by Nucleus Security. Its APAC manager, Gil Azaria, joins the show in this week's sponsor interview to basically tell the story of how he first became a Nucleus customer when he worked for a large Australian logistics organization, and then he'll talk about how he wound up becoming their regional manager in this part of the world. And it's funny too, because he was actually pretty nervous going into the interview, and then he turned in basically a flawless performance. It's really interesting. Nucleus makes a vulnerability data aggregator, I guess, is a good way to describe it. But it has use cases across ops and dev. And if you listen to that interview, you will certainly have a better idea of what it is they do. I found that interview interesting. I hope you do too. That is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, I mean, how are we going to fill a news segment? It's been such a quiet week.
Yeah, nothing of interest has happened at all. It's been boring.
Completely boring. Well, let's talk about Exchangerpalooza 21, right? Because, you know, last week we spoke about how, you know, there was evidence emerging of a Chinese APT crew that was going out there exploiting exchange boxes with an O-Day chain. And things have escalated a little bit.
Yes, they certainly have. Since the bug got more publicity, we've seen just a flurry of exploitation by the original Hafnium crew that have been doing it. And then, of course, a bunch of other people have jumped on the bandwagons, both, you know, kind of unattributed nation-statey looking people and cybercrime crews, ransomware crews. Everybody is getting a piece of Exchange at the moment. And it's turned into, you know, really one of the very big stories. I mean, this makes SolarWinds just kind of look boring by comparison. SolarWinds is, you know, workaday espionage. This just has the potential to be really, you know, I mean, this, you know, makes even some of the, you know, like NotPetya or other campaigns that had real impact, you know, if this got turned into global ransomware, that would, you know, could really be very, very big. But it's just, you know, it's such an interesting story with, you know, the timeline of the bug, its discovery and its use and all that kind of thing. Plus, the way we've seen this communicated in the media. And then, of course, you know, what we're going to see this, you know, do in terms of the geopolitics, given we've seen strong finger pointing towards China as the original operator.
Yeah, now you mentioned the timeline. It's interesting, right? Because Brett's last newsletter was yesterday. He has now moved on from Risky Biz, which is very sad. Hi, Brett. I know you're listening. He starts at Okta next week. But in his last newsletter, it was funny, right? Because we usually will get together on a Monday and work through an outline of the newsletter for the next day. And just reading through the write-up on all of this, I said to him, I think we need to do a timeline here because it's just there's so many different moving parts. Explain to the listeners why this is interesting, right? Because it looks like DevCore and Orange Sci in Taiwan started for some reason looking into exchange bugs in October last year, right? They wound up reporting these bugs to Microsoft on Jan 5. But, you know, you got to ask the question, why were they looking at exchange bugs in October 2020? Like, what prompted that? You know, there's so many unanswered questions here.
Yeah, no, it's certainly been a very interesting bit of a timeline that. I mean, the Orange Sci found the bugs, reported them to Microsoft. And then the timeline he published says they started looking around October, found the bugs December, reporting to Microsoft. Some of the Hafnium activity that was originally reported was a couple of days prior to Microsoft. But now we've seen, you know, evidence that there's been attacks, you know, going back into last year. And the idea that you might see, I don't know, an exchange bug being used in Taiwan, where Orange Sci and DevCore are based,
Long bow to draw, is it? I mean,
it's
obviously,
not. Exactly.
We don't have any information to suggest that's what's happened, but there's so many weird coincidences in here, right? So it looks like, exploitation. Someone was exploiting this bug chain last year. DevCore and Orange Sci found some of these bugs, reported them to Microsoft in early January, and then rapidly after that, things started escalating, right?
And we've seen, you know, examples of groups other than the original Hafnium group starting to leap on this bug, you know, a little bit before Microsoft started releasing details and patches, which suggests perhaps a leak in some of the, you know, embargoed early access process to some Microsoft patches, which, you know, that is a pretty big community these days. So it's not unusual for things to kind of, you know, get a little bit loose there. And we haven't seen, I guess, enough details, but, you know, clearly these bugs are pretty straightforward for people to be in, then be able to turn into working stuff once they either seen patches or got some information about what specifically they were looking for. But it really has turned into such a mess. You know, Microsoft has done some good work getting patches there out of band. We've seen them patch back to Exchange 2010. It's certainly sobering also considering that these bugs have been around for, you know, probably 10 plus years, given that Exchange 2010 was affected. And you've got to wonder whether there's any kind of, you know, whether when people go back and look now, we'll find any other evidence of people using this bug before. Because Exchange is a very natural candidate to go look for some real juicy remotes. And, you know, certainly the impact of compromising Exchange is a thing that I don't know that the reporting so far has really captured. Because, yeah, it's just a natural target. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
Now, look, some of the reporting suggests that this original, you know, state-linked Chinese crew may have compromised tens of thousands of servers just on their own before this escalation, before everybody else started using it, this bug chain. And one of the problems is they were leaving behind a web shell that does not require authentication for people to access that box with, right? So what we got is a situation where I'm guessing a lot of boxes are going to get patched, but they're going to have web shells all over them, so those patches don't mean really that much.
Well, exactly right. And this is, you know, the core advice, which was go patch your stuff, isn't super effective when A, you've already been owned, and B, as you say, like, there may be half a dozen web shells. I mean, we've seen reports of Exchange boxes, you know, with half a dozen different web shells on it, you know, and a whole bunch of people have compromised that. And yeah, just applying a patch when that has happened is obviously not useful. And we've also seen, I guess, focus on what you would do once you've compromised the Exchange being, hey, you could take people's emails. And clearly the Chinese crew that was doing that was doing that on specific, you know, cases that they had broken in and they found a target of value. But, you know, access to Exchange buys you so much more than just access to emails. I mean, it's almost, in most cases, probably going to be directly domain administrator or a very, very short, well-known, you know, kind of default configuration to go from there to domain admin. And certainly if you were one of the groups that got onto this bandwagon late, you know, when you know that there's going to be a heap of attention on Exchange, you know, everyone's paying attention, rolling response, looking for stuff, you're not going to go and roll into Exchange and expect that your web shell that looks, you know, just like the Chinese one is going to last, right? You're going to go in there with a plan to get the hell off that box, you know, move laterally as fast as you can to survive the inevitable kind of, you know, patching and response process. So, you know, the fact that there's a few web shells lying around, you know, those are the bad, sloppy actors. The ones that went into this prepared, like had a meeting, you know, decided what they were going to do, you know, show up in a hot landing zone. You don't hang around. You get the hell out of there and, you know, make a foxhole in the next ridge line over, much as we hate military.
Well, nowadays, take all the creds with you as well. And apparently when you run Mimikatz on these things, they rain clear text creds because of active sync.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, if you arrive on an Exchange box, you've got so many great options. Yeah, creds from ActiveSync, you know, moving laterally through the Exchange, like the typical Exchange domain permissions have write DACL writes into the Active Directory, so you can kind of modify groups and memberships and things to move up into domain admin. That's a pretty well-known technique. And of course, the contents of the email gets you a bunch of other stuff for lateral movement options. So yeah, you've just got so many good places to go. And if you were a competent professional attacker crew, which, you know, these people get paid to do it, so they are, you're absolutely going to move off that box. And throwing someone out of your environment that's got domain admin, you know, is going to take more than patching your Exchange.
Yeah, it is. And apparently, look, you know, if other reports are to be believed, there's like, you know, everybody's trying to evict everybody else out of the boxes. Like it's like, you know, everybody's fighting to build an Exchange botnet. Right. I mean, no, we're used to seeing this stuff happen with home routers, but not with,
you know, corporate mail
serious
service.
Corporate mail servers. Right. So this is terrible. Look, Katie Nichols is the director of intelligence at Red Canary, and she had some thoughts to share with us. Here she is.
The challenge of the situation is that no one really knows how many victims there are. We can estimate based on scans that researchers have done of the internet, but no organization knows for sure if the numbers are in the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Honestly, regardless of the numbers, organizations need to take this seriously. If organizations haven't patched already by now, they should honestly assume compromise. My team released a blog post today trying to make it as simple as possible to respond if an organization thinks they might have been compromised. The challenge of this is that based on the scale, it's likely that an average Exchange administrator is probably going to be responding to a lot of these incidents. It's not possible for small organizations to necessarily bring in an incident response team. And so, you know, the focus my team had as we were publishing our blog is trying to make guidance accessible for the average administrator. And so I think that this is serious. It's widespread, but I think we need to kind of find that balance between panicking versus taking it seriously and trying to spread actionable guidance for organizations.
And we'll link through, of course, to Katie's Katie and her team's blog post in this week's show notes. But it is interesting, isn't it, that we've seen this big thing come out of the US government, like all this saber rattling over the SolarWinds stuff, like, oh, you know, they've been in our supply chain. And, it, you know, we said on this show, it looks like they were pretty careful to exclude organizations that weren't their targets. Like, it was actually a pretty restrained operation. And, you know, this really is a hold my beer moment. Holiday Bear, hold my beer. I'm going to show you what an irresponsible exploitation looks like. And this is it. I mean, you know, this is worth getting mad about, in my view.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to have that contrast presented to us kind of so close together. I mean, the contrast between the Russians with SolarWinds, you know, it does look responsible by comparison. And I think, you know, Dmitry wrote a piece talking about, you know, all the things that Russia has done that is worth getting worked up about, you know, in Ukraine and, you know, with NotPetya and all those sorts of things. Like, there's plenty of examples of things they've done irresponsibly, and SolarWinds perhaps wasn't one of them. And this does kind of show by contrast, as you say, like what irresponsible looks like. And, you know, dropping unauthed web shells, certainly pretty irresponsible. And then the way that it's just kind of scaled up and turned into a feeding frenzy, you know, also perhaps not lined up with, you know, espionage goals. And, you know, we don't necessarily know that the Hafnium was about espionage, or kind of feels like it. But the idea that now, you know, every web-facing exchange on the internet got itself owned, like that's a...
Every single OWA in the world at the moment is owned. Unless I would be very surprised to find an OWA box on the internet, even if you did patch it in a timely manner, because it looks like Hafnium were actually automating the exploitation, right? They were just dropping web shells on everything. And so you just think, would there even be many that didn't get rinsed?
I mean, certainly the experience of people running Exchange honeypots at the moment is that they get wrecked real fast.
Some people might have managed to sidestep it by patching very, very quickly, and maybe they just, I don't know, maybe their box was down when the
Exchange server in the back office. So the classic domain controller in a back office that hadn't been ransomware, and they can restore the backups from that. Yeah, that might save you. But yeah, I think, you know, people who got advice from Microsoft early, perhaps, I'm sure there's, you know, some customers that were in that boat, maybe they managed to dodge it. And obviously Microsoft managed to dodge it with, you know, the cloud-based Exchange. And let's face it, one of the real winners here may well be Microsoft's cloud services, because, you know, everybody who's in the cloud didn't get owned, and everybody who's on-prem got owned. Pretty compelling sales pitch for Microsoft to, you know, uplift people into the cloud and upsell them some, you know, more subscriptions and things, which is an interesting conflict of, you know, of... incentives there.
Conflicted incentives seems to be their fastest growing product line, actually, Microsoft. But look, you know, Caesar has very helpfully, you know, on March 3, ordered US agencies to address Microsoft flaws exploited by suspected Chinese hackers. And I mean, that's all well and good, but I think the point we're trying to make is that it's too late for that now.
Yes, yeah, I think it is. I think if you have Exchange, then you should be rolling incident response at this point. And if you're not, then you need to have a very good reason why not. Like, you need to be able to explain why you are not owned, which kind of is the same as incident response. So, yeah, I mean...
It's going to take a while before we have truly understand the scale of this and, like, the mop-up is done, right? Like, this is...
Yeah, I mean... You know, Accelion was saying what, like they had 2/3 of their customers owned or half their customers, whatever the number was, right? Which is a few hundred. And look how big that turned into when a ransomware, you know, a smart ransomware crew did it. This is how many orders of magnitude bigger in terms of number of places compromised? If it was the Klopp crew, can you imagine the scale that would be? I mean, you know, just ransoming that many people would be, you know, a real challenge for them. So
yeah, trying to do that sort of attack at scale, right? Like just the key management alone. That's they could write us
hire a whole other call center to handle all of the inbound ransom
and
payments.
And then write us a white paper on how they did it.
Yeah, exactly. They'd have to use Amazon, scale it up.
Maybe we can do a webinar with them. Encryption at scale. Yeah. So look, you know, obviously this is a story that, like the SolarWinds stuff, the poorly named SolarWinds stuff, this is something we'll be talking about for a while, I think. So let's move on to some other stories. Hey, interesting one here from SecureWorks put out a report. Now, we spoke a while ago about how some Chinese APT crew was actually using SolarWinds in a post-exploitation setting. Like they had some SolarWinds bugs that they were using to then, you know, propagate through networks, move laterally, that sort of thing. SecureWorks has dropped a report here which showed that a Chinese APT crew actually used SolarWinds ODAY as their way into an environment because someone had exposed their SolarWinds to the internet, which I'm going to just say is probably not the best idea.
Not the best idea, no. And yeah, SolarWinds is another great target, right? And if you put it out on the internet, that would be a terrible idea. But even for internal escalation and lateral movement, it's a really great way to do that. And also for crossing security zones, because it tends to be like places that have segregated Active Directory may share SolarWinds across zones. And that's a lateral movement technique that makes a whole bunch of sense.
Yeah. Now, look, staying on SolarWinds, and, you know, we were just talking about this whole concept of the United States, you know, talking about retaliating against Russia. The New York Times ran a story saying that there were going to be cyber strikes against Russia, and then they actually wound up changing their headline and changing their text, not even putting a correction notice on the story, which is a very New York Times sort of thing to do. But, you know, there is talk that there's going to be some sort of retaliation for the SolarWinds stuff. I don't know that that's, yeah, I mean, as you said, Dimitri has been talking about how, Dimitri is the fifth Beatle of the Risky Business podcast, by the way, for anyone who's wondering. You know, we spend a lot of time talking to him. But, you know, he's been saying, you know, there's plenty of other stuff that they've done which is out of bounds, you know, like why not target that? And Andy Greenberg at Wired has actually written up a really good piece here just about all of that.
Yeah, he kind of talks through, you know, the planned response that we've seen, you know, so let's talk about it. And as you said, like New York Times made it sound like they were planning one particular thing, and then subsequent kind of corrections from the White House said that, you know, cyber strike was the New York Times wording, not the White House's. So that kind of led to the change that you talked about. But yeah, kind of talks through, you know, in the end, this is, the SolarWinds campaign looks like espionage and, you know, going and rattling the saber at Russia when the US not only does the same sorts of things, but is probably better at it and does it at large scale and has done, you know, things that probably are worse than the SolarWinds.
I really wasn't sure about that because I'm thinking there's no way the US could legally do something similar, you know, like a supply chain attack, even against against US vendor, no way, right? But against an offshore vendor like Huawei, Kaspersky, could they legally do that if it's going to result in code execution against American computers, right? Or computers located in countries of allies and whatnot. And I was thinking no way, but a few people have said, yeah, they can probably do that, man. You know, so yeah, they've got to think carefully about what they want to say is out of bounds, right? Because it could be limiting.
Exactly right. And if they go and say, hey, we want to set the whole bunch of norms about this and that, then, you know, they do need to look at themselves and kind of decide how many of those they're already violating. Because obviously if you set some norms and then don't abide by them yourself, you've kind of worsened your overall position. Or you go and set norms and abide by them and lose a bunch of capability that you were relying on. Certainly we've seen a few people who work in the IC on InfoSec Twitter, you know, posting confused face memes, you know, about the idea that this operation was, you know, beyond the bounds of what would be authorized as espionage, because that's the sort of thing that they're already doing. So yeah, it's a little bit unclear whether going and beating up the Russians about this particular campaign would really serve US interests in, you know, kind of stopping this from escalating further. And, you know, as we've said, like there's a bunch of other things that are totally worth, you know, shaking the fist at Russia about. But
yeah, this ain't it.
This one, a little bit awkward.
This ain't it. I mean, you know, it's entirely possible that what the US government is talking about and planning is just going burning down some of their C2s and, you know, standard sort of counterintelligence stuff, right?
Yeah, they got a bunch of options of things they can do that just kind of, you know, harass them and make their lives difficult. And we've seen similar sorts of things against the Internet Research Agency, for example, and other things during the elections. But, you know, given that the Chinese got away with the OPM hack, which is probably worse.
Well, but that was legitimate. I mean, even senior figures in the intelligence community said that was legitimate. Like, that was...
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of my point, right? We accepted that that was probably legit intelligence gathering, and the SolarWinds probably not as bad as that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't make a whole bunch of
Let's
sense.
Let's all move on, basically. Let's all move on. Now, look, speaking of retaliatory actions... Krebs on Security reports that Russian cybercrime forums are having a bit of a hard time right now. Now, there's the boring explanation, which is that it's rival crews. Like, if anyone hasn't read it, check out the book Kingpin by Kevin Paulson, which is about Max Ray Vision and his forced consolidation of the underground scene, quite a number of years ago now, where he basically just owned all the carding sites, imported their user databases and said, congratulations, you're all members of my site now. And yeah, he wrote the whole book about that. So it could be something like that, which would be the boring explanation, but we have seen policy shifts signaled by governments like in the UK, where they're like, hey, we've got all these, cyber operators. Why don't we put them to good use against crooks? This seems like, maybe it's something like that. And if it is, why would you not use your government-employed hackers to do something like this? It's a great little disruption exercise.
Yeah, it's certainly, when I read this story on Krebs, which talks about the big underground site Motherfucker being owned, having their database dumped, and the database contains user records, including things like IP addresses of first registrations of the accounts and ICQ numbers, which is a great way to tie together a bunch of disparate accounts because it kind of goes further back in history than OPSEC was necessary for criminals, and then dumps some private keys and a bunch of other stuff really designed to thoroughly degrade trust in that community. And to see that pattern repeated in, three or four crime forums in a very short space of time.
It feels a little bit like the whiteboard that we talk about sometimes, right?
Exactly. It feels like someone had a meeting and coordinated a bunch of plans. And as you say, you've got these hackers sitting around on the government payroll. They may as well be doing something useful. And, there's been, is this what a hound being released looks like? I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe there's four hounds.
I mean, this is the thing, right? We have no idea whether or not this is a government action. For all we know, it's crooks on crooks. But it just is the sort of thing that we're expecting to see, right? And why would you not do this? It's like a day's work. And look, it makes the threat intelligence people cry, right? When stuff like this happens, because they lose all of their access to these forums and whatever. But come on, life isn't all about keeping threat intel people happy. Sorry, guys.
and that's the thing. We've talked so much about innovation in the cybercrime world and the way that they've turned into this kind of as a service model. And there's a real thriving, ecosystem of providers that all kind of sell to each other and do business. And this is really about trashing the trust in their marketplace. And that's kind of more important than having threat intel about the operation of the marketplace. Because the ultimate point of that threat intel is to be able to disrupt it. This is disruption.
Yes.
Whether or not it's crook on crook, as you say, we don't really know. But it almost kind of doesn't matter, because dropping stuff like this is going to promote crook on crook, because there's always bad blood and feuds and people who feel ripped off. And now all the data is there to go and tie back to real people's identities. You force the marketplace to fall on itself in the same way as if it was crook on crook to start with. And anything that introduces friction in this kind of modern cybercrime ecosystem is going to degrade their capability overall. And that's kind of what the IC has been charged to do. So yeah,
I'm sick of the argument that it sends them underground and that's bad. No, that's good, because being underground is harder, right? you're sort of dealing with some of the scale problem there. Now, you mentioned the Excellion stuff just earlier. Lily Hay Newman over at Wired has written this story, and I love this headline: "The Excellion breach keeps getting worse and more expensive." And, they sort of take a look back about how, it was this quiet little thing that sort of, rumblings of it around late December. And then, in the last couple of weeks, it's become a big deal. As regular listeners would know, it was Brett Winifred working for us who did, some of the leading journalism, I believe, on this. And every time you look at this thing, it's bigger.
Yeah, and new victims keep coming out of the woodwork. We saw what Qualys we talked about last week getting themselves added to the list, but it's just going to keep going, right? Because so many people use this thing, and it does feel like the ransomware crew, the Clop crew, are kind of doling it out slowly. I'm not sure whether that's like a infrastructure scaling issue.
And the proportion was actually, Excellion claimed it was 1/3 of their customers, less than 1/3, which was their great metric. But then you think, well, maybe that list has grown a little bit even over the last week, because we've got a story here from Motherboard saying Flagstar Bank, their workers are being like shaken down because their social security numbers and their names and their home addresses are being leaked by Klopp, right? Because this is an Accelion related campaign. As you mentioned, Qualys. Like, it's just, it seems like they probably got everyone.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that's probably the case. I think it is going to be one third of our customers and growing, you know, graphs going up. Good job.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think if you were an Accelion customer and you haven't yet been ransomed, then you probably need to prepare yourself because, you know, if it worked well for this many places, why wouldn't they keep going? And certainly, you know, their dedication to doing a good job of this from a ransomware point of view does seem to be pretty strong. So they must be, you know, making some money.
Catalin Kimpanu, of course, now works for the Recorded Future blog, The Record, and he has filed a story here saying that the Reval crew are about to get even more heinous.
Yeah, this is the story talks about them promoting new services that they've built into their crime as a service offering, which includes the ability to ring customers and journalists and other people involved in a kind of company's network to pass on the good news that they have been ransomed and are currently not paying. And perhaps, you know, some pressure could be applied, you know, through whatever means. And, you know, the example of taking a bunch of employees' details and dropping them, like we saw with the example with the Flagstar Bank that you just mentioned, where they were, you know, showing that they had the details, you know, social security numbers and things of staff to go and apply pressure to the management to go and pay up and make the problem go away. Doing the same thing with business partners and journalists and customers, like that's a smart way to improve the efficacy of your campaigns. So yeah, very innovative there for Reval.
Another thing that they floated doing is actually DDoSing the targets to make recovery harder if they're trying to recover without paying, which is just like, can you imagine you're going through some sort of link saturation attack while you're trying to pull down, you know, clean images and stuff. Like, what a nightmare.
Your Windows updates and stuff.
Yeah.
No, I mean, anything that's going to make your life more complicated. I mean, and clearly, you know, part of it is they need to be able to do it. And they also just, you know, even just threatening, like having the capability on the shelf saying, hey, you know, here are the five things that we can do and having a record of having done them to set examples for other victims. You know, these crews, they know what they're doing, right? They're good at this.
Now, this is the third time we've spoken about this. You know, that bloke put out a paper about this dependency confusion supply chain attack. It's escalated. It's turned into kind of a thing now.
Yeah, this has really escalated. A lot of people have looked at this technique and gone, oh, yeah, that's really going to work. And we've seen, you know, because the attacks rely on using public code repositories as kind of the input vector, it makes monitoring this and understanding who's doing it and what they're trying to do actually quite interesting. So it's a good example of an attack where we have much better than average visibility of what's going on. And there are thousands of packages popping up in the, you know, the Node and the Python package repos. And because you have to kind of collide with internal names to do this, you get an idea of who's being attacked. And looking at what the code's trying to do gives you an idea of what the potential goals might be. So yeah, it's just interesting having a view into how a paper like this then gets turned into weaponized attacks at scale.
Because I think, you know, we spoke about it, about his very interesting blog, and then later on we were like, well, you can see people are actually doing some sort of proof of concept, like they're sort of trying it out, but with like null payloads, right? No payloads. And now it's like, wow, there's 5,000 malicious packages out there. Just, yeah.
One of the examples we've seen from this was Microsoft Teams. Its build system being attacked and getting callbacks from JavaScript running inside Microsoft. So good example of how difficult a problem this is to solve, even at a very software dev-centric org like Microsoft.
Jeez, that's not really what you want, is it? Microsoft Teams.
It's really, really, really not. Because, I mean, you think about how bad this Exchange thing was on-prem. Imagine the Exchange thing, but in the cloud. Like, imagine if it's Teams getting exfilled and ransomed. My God.
Shut up. We got two more from Catalin here. And look, this isn't the sort of story that you'd normally find terribly interesting. It's about a botnet, like an Android botnet called FluBot, that was targeting banking customers in Spain. What makes it really, really noteworthy is how successful it was and very, very quickly. Over a space of 2 months, it just... You know, they really did a little bit too well, because as you'll discover in the next story, the people behind it have already been arrested. But walk us through this this little Android banking Trojan.
Yeah, so this is an Android banking Trojan that you have to kind of, you know, click through and install from an APK, you know, and typically you're going to get an SMS message that, you know, leads you through that process and convinces you that's the right thing to do. Then it asks for accessibility privileges so that it can do, like, you know, pop over auth messages and steal your creds and, you know, normal sort of banking Trojan things. But it also harvests the address book and then sends that back to the attackers, and then they use that to then start the SMS propagation process all over again. And this campaign compromised something like 60,000 devices, 97% in Spain, which is really interesting. But they said that the attackers had got something like 11% of the people in Spain's phone numbers.
Oh, no. They have 11 million phone numbers representing 25% of the total population in Spain. Right? And that just shows you, like, they're thinking about it like Facebook would, you know?
Yes, yeah.
Like, build that social graph, guys, you know?
Yeah, no, it's certainly smart thinking. What's not smart thinking is doing this in the country that you live.
Yes, that was not a good idea because they've been arrested.
Yeah, doing this inside Spain where you're going to get arrested by the Spanish, not such a smart plan.
Four men aged between 19 and 27 were arrested in Barcelona on Tuesday, March 2. So there you go. But links to those two pieces are in this week's show notes. Gab got owned again. Now, what's really interesting, right? I don't know if listeners remember this, but it was something that you said a few times when we were talking about Gab and Parler. You mentioned a couple of times that you thought they were going to get owned because running a social network, something with that much attack surface, right, and small budgets, you were pretty convinced this was going to happen. And boy, were you right, because yeah, they are having a very hard time.
They got owned, a few weeks ago by SQL injection, bunch of database contents dumped. That was bad. They fixed the SQL injection badly, you know, all fine. It turns out that they didn't revoke a bunch of the bearer tokens used for mobile app auth back into the platform, which of course was stored in the database. So the attackers that stole the database, which I guess was everybody, are then still able to authenticate. And then someone has logged in to Gab as the CEO's account and posted a message mocking him and saying, hey, we hacked everything, and then posted a mosaic image made up of people's like identity verification photos from Gab. That's pretty funny.
Arranged in a shape to look like Captain Jack Sparrow, no less.
Yes, the attacker in question's name is Captain Jack Sparrow in Leet Speak. And then, a beautiful artistic image of Jack Sparrow. So nicely done hacker guy there.
Now, speaking of crazy assholes, John McAfee, he's in a bit of trouble. This is the stuff that he was doing. Man, he's been arrested for the crypto pump and dumps, right? That he was doing, when was that? Between December 2017 and October 2018. And anyone who paid half attention to, you know, Twitter would have seen John McAfee promoting various ICOs. And he was clearly, very, very clearly doing pump and dumps and also accepting money from other people to promote their pumps and dumps, right? Like, it was just so obvious that he was committing crimes in the open. I'm frankly a little bit surprised it's taken this long to catch up with him, but it has caught up with him. He is looking down the barrel of up to 30 years in prison on these charges, and he's already been detained in Spain. He's awaiting extradition on tax fraud charges. So, yeah, old mate John McAfee not having a good time.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly amazing, given, you know, all of the alleged acts and crimes and things that McAfee may or may not have done, that this is the one that he ends up, you know, getting into real trouble for. But yeah, I do wonder. I mean, the crypto ecosystem is so prone to this kind of thing, and the fact that you have to do it, you know, as flagrantly as he did in order to get in trouble, I guess makes you wonder a bit. But hey, you know, if he ends up getting extradited and convicted, then I don't know that I'm going to be super sad about that.
Flagrant is his middle name. Now this is an intriguing story, this one, right? GitHub announced via a tweet that they had de-authed everyone. You know, and their tweet was like, no big deal, we've just de-authed all of our users. And I think someone quote tweeted it and was like, say what now? Which was kind of my reaction as well. But yeah, GitHub de-authed everyone. Why?
So they made a blog post saying that there was some kind of race condition in one of their back-end services that could end up serving the results of one user's request to another user, which would imply also leaking their session cookies and things to the second user. So potential for cross-account access. They say that it's just a race condition and it wasn't a thing that was controllable by end users, i.e. that an attacker couldn't have otherwise leveraged this. And it was a very small percentage of sessions. But on the other hand, GitHub's very big, does a lot of important things. And I guess I'm kind of glad that they are willing to kind of take the PR hit and just go away and invalidate everybody else's sessions and have all of the speculation about, oh my God, a bad thing happened, when it didn't, presumably, because there was some potential there. And so, yeah, I think this seems like a good response.
Look, I think you're right, but we're just not used to seeing that sort of messaging around something so big, right? Which is like, yeah, we've de-authed absolutely everyone just to be cautious, isn't something you can normally believe.
No, and it's kind of, you know, I certainly want to believe because, I mean, GitHub is such an important part of the ecosystem and, you know, they do have a bunch of really smart people doing a real good job there. And this is the sort of thing that you as a big cloud platform, need to be willing to do, right? You need to be willing to go, hey, abundance of caution, let's boot everybody off, make everybody re-auth. We'll wear the people, you know, smack-talking us on Twitter because it's important and important we get this right.
Well, and they're going to wear the support costs of the number of people they've probably locked out of their accounts by accident. But no, look, the right thing to do. But
yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Look, this next one is sort of way down the back of the news list because there's just so much we don't know about it. I'm talking, of course, about the CETA breach. Adam, tell us what CETA is and what we know here.
So CETA is a Swiss-based like airline services company that does you know, a bunch of integration between airlines. And there's basically like three companies in the world that do this kind of stuff. So they have a pretty big share of airlines. They had some kind of breach that resulted in passenger loyalty data being leaked. And we've seen notifications come out of a bunch of the airlines saying, hey, you know, one of our vendors lost a bunch of your data and it's limited to, you know, kind of frequent flyer numbers and your name and, you know, little bits of information like that and not, you know, payment or travel details or things you know, that are more serious. We don't really know whether it was a system at CETA, whether it was some third-party thing. We've seen a couple of conflicting reports about exactly how the breach happened. But yeah, certainly everybody who has an airline frequent flyer account probably got a breach notification mail this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear as mud exactly what type of data was leaked, whether it's like, you know, passenger movement information, or I mean, in some cases, they're just saying it's like your loyalty number and like very limited information. So it's just, it's remarkable to me how much we don't know. And I'm sort of surprised there isn't more media on this because there are questions that should be answered here. Of course, you know, flight related data is a very juicy target for state-backed, you know, crews. I mean, it's a huge espionage target. So I'm sort of surprised it's not attracting that much attention yet. I mean, it could just be run-of-the-mill crooks. It could be opportunistic attackers. We don't know. But that's kind of my point, right? Like, we should know more about this.
Yeah, certainly for these kinds of very big integration systems that have so much data, like we do kind of want to understand what happened. And, you know, there's so much attack service in those environments and a bit more focus on it, I think would be useful. I mean, even if this breach turned out to be, you know, hey, they just left some text files that were being imported on their Accelerant and they got them stolen. Okay, fair enough. But yeah, understanding how all these systems tie together is kind of important for people.
Now, this next story, I'm so glad we get to talk about this. I'm only aware of it because Catalan wrote it up, so good job, Catalan. Ollie Whitehouse is the group CTO at NCC Group, and for people who've been in InfoSec for a long time, you know, you'd recognize the name because he's, you know, a very, very smart dude, and he's been around for a long time. And he's done what can probably best be described as a bit of deception engineering, I guess. I just vomited a little bit saying that, but it's probably the best description. Walk us through what Ollie's put together because it is just such a good idea.
This is such a beautiful thing. And yeah, Ollie Whitehouse, certainly a name that's been around these parts for a very, very long time. And this kind of real smart, I mean, and deception engineering is a terrible term, but it's exactly what this is. So he's come up with a thing which he has called Killed Process Canary. And the idea is that a bunch of pieces of malware that land in a box, one of the first things they're going to do is look and see what AV is running, look and understand what host agents are running, and if possible, kill them, right? So they can operate with more impunity, bring extra payloads, go about their business. So he's come up with a thing that runs a bunch of processes that has common names of things like antivirus, scanners, or whatever. And if any one of those processes gets killed, the other fake processes that are running notice that one of their brethren is missing and fire off a DNS canary token. And then shut the box down, like put it into hibernate so that the memory state is safe so you can go look at it. If it's ransomware, which is the main thing he was targeting with this, perhaps the key material is still in memory so you can use that to decrypt perhaps other boxes that didn't get caught. And at the very least, you kind of stopped the infection process from carrying on. And this is just real smart because, you know, you're taking advantage of the behavior that the ransomware kind of needs to do to be able to work well. And unless they kill all of them simultaneously, then it's, you know, pretty likely that the kind of lockstep behavior between all of the fake processes, you know, catches what's going on. And of course, you know, it's part of an overall arms race. And, you know, if this was widely deployed, we'd see countermeasures taken against it. But you have to know that this is in play to be able to do that. So this is going to save, I imagine, probably quite a few people's boxes if you go ahead and use it. So yes.
Smart. Well, I mean, just imagine, you know, that you've been ransomwared overnight. Okay. You come back in, everything is ransomwared, and you've got a hibernating box over in the corner with the recovery key in it.
Yeah, like that's a beautiful thing. I mean, for many organizations, the idea that you have a script that can auto hibernate a bunch of your boxes, like the chances of that going wrong, availability impact is a thing you'd want to weigh up. But yeah, if that day happened where you got ransomware and you had a copy of the key in a hiber file, yeah, you would feel like everyone would be buying you drinks down at the pub that night. That would be a good time.
Man, you would get drinks for years.
You would.
That, I mean, that's just great. Now, we've got a bit of research to walk through here. This one was written up by Adam Bannister for the Daily Swig, and it's about JSON parsers. And it's interesting stuff, but I got to be honest, it's a little bit over my head. Talk us through it.
Yeah, so this is a write-up of some research that came out of Bishop Fox, written up by Jake Miller over on their tech blog. And it looks at interoperability issues between JSON parsers and a bunch of places where JSON parsers kind of arrive at the different conclusions about the data that they are producing or writing out into JSON streams. A good example, and the most digestible one, is if you have two values with the same name, which one matters, which one, whether it's the first one or the second one. And this looks at several classes of JSON interoperability bugs where different parsers arrive at different conclusions and kind of tabulates all of those. And because so many modern applications are microservicey and built out of heaps of components, often JSON is the language used between those components. And if you have a JavaScript node app talking to a Golang app, talking to a Python app, and they're all using their own JSON parsers to parse and then regenerate new docs, you can end up with very different interpretations of that data, which is very fertile ground for all sorts of really interesting application bugs. And the blog post that Bishop Fox puts together has some real good examples of what that would mean for like a shopping cart system or some other system where you could say manipulate the understanding of the value between different layers of the application through JSON. So if you're a web pen tester, this is absolutely your must read blog post of the week. This cast of canonicalization bugs is super fertile, and you will find bugs with this. Definitely go and read it.
Now, we do actually have a skateboarding dog this week. Adam, it's a pretty funny story. CyberScoop wrote it up, but it's based on a blog post from a gentleman named Luke Leal. And it's about a BEC scammer who infected themselves. Probably they were testing their malware and they infected themselves, but they forgot to uninstall it when they rolled out their campaign. So we've got all of this juicy insight into behind the scenes of a BEC scam.
Yeah, they apparently they got into the web panel that was the back end of the software that was being used in this campaign. And yeah, because the guy had infected himself and the system sent screenshots regularly, they were able to kind of ride along with this guy's BEC campaign and then even see him complaining on the internal crime chat about having lost access to his web panel. So yeah, it was pretty funny. And when you see the insides of these campaigns, it's always nice to see the real world day-to-day grind of being a scammer.
That's it. It's a hard life. NSA has put out some guidance on zero trust. I would say they've really done a good job walking the fine line between saying, yes, zero trust is the solution to a whole bunch of problems, and the opposite of that. Like they've threaded the needle here on this one, and it's just a great document.
Yeah, it is. It's a good summary of zero trust and kind of what it is and what you have to do to get it right. And kind of framed in a context of the sort of trad computer science-y approach to thinking about security that hasn't always done us so well in the past, but it's kind of fits it all together in that framework so that you can think about this in quite a structured way, which is what you'd expect from a paper that came out of the NSA. But yeah, if you are in the process of thinking about how to fit zero trust in your organization, and what that kind of interim state where you haven't done it all yet looks like and the things you need to think about, certainly worth a read.
NSA and CISA has also put out some guidance urging people to use protective DNS. They've got a matrix here with a bunch of vendors in it. I was surprised that AlphaSock wasn't in there, actually. Probably because they're small, but they do really cool stuff. And they're not just taking known bad domains. AlphaSock, they'll do stuff like, lol, that domain's a day old. Block it, which you'd be amazed how much stuff that that actually eliminates. But yeah, they're certainly advising organizations to just use filtered DNS, basically, which seems like good advice.
Yeah, we saw them say that US government agencies should be using the one that they kind of operate, which you know gives great telemetry about DNS and a bunch of protection things. And they've kind of talked through some of the other you know commercial vendors that provide this kind of set of features. And it really does underscore just how useful DNS is as a you know, telemetry mechanism for understanding what's going on in your environment. And even more so now that we've got you know DNS over TLS or HTTPS, you know, as alternative transports that are less visible unless you go and put a you know server that you control in the middle. So yeah, a good write-up of what your options are if you're trying to do this outside of the US government.
Rightio. Well, Adam, that's actually it for this week, this very quiet week of news. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you. And I should mention too that both you and me have both had colds that we're still kind of recovering from. It's been a bit crap, actually, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a good week to kind of sit back and watch the internet burn whilst, you know, also sipping hot lemon or something.
Yeah, pretty much. You rest up, feel better. I'll do the same. And yeah, it was great to talk to you and we'll do it all again next week. Cheers.
We certainly will. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Gil Azaria, the Director of APAC Operations for Nucleus Security. And yeah, I mean, I really like what Nucleus is about. It basically takes the output from a bunch of different security tools like vuln scanners, static analysis tools, software composition analysis tools, asset discovery tools, all of that good stuff. They take the output from those tools and then they normalize that data. They put it in a central repository, and then you can plumb that data through to the people who are in the best position to use it. So it's really good for getting that central view from a bunch of different perspectives and angles. So Gil actually started off as a Nucleus customer. He worked for a massive logistics organization here in Australia in a web AppSec role. And he was looking for a tool to help him to help developers, basically. And he was really surprised that he couldn't find much in terms of vulnerability aggregators, right? So in this interview, he basically walks us through how he wound up discovering Nucleus in his previous role and then rolling it out, and then talks about how he wound up working for Nucleus and what its customers are using it for. Now, as I said at the top of the show, Gil was actually a little nervous when we started rolling, but he absolutely smashed this interview. And like his nervousness to performance ratio was very different from what I'm used to. He did really well. So I hope you find this interview as interesting as I did. Here's Gil Azaria.
So look, I was running a project at my previous organization to put in tools to help make developers go faster, essentially. We were looking at an SCA, we're looking at a SAST, and the kind of cornerstone of the project was to be transparent and to give power to the devs to be able to look at their own vulnerabilities, get you know an aggregated view of it, and then make informed decisions on what they were going to do next. And I like, you know, I looked at, I spent, you know, I didn't spend much time on the SAST or SCA part. That was reasonably easy. The market was quite mature at the time. And then we proceeded to spend like 5 months doing product evaluations across like 7 or 8 products. And honestly, at the end, I was ripping my hair out because there was nothing that was anything like, it was terrible. It was really, everything was terrible. I mean, no one had really started doing vulnerability aggregation for AppSec. No one was doing it from a developer first point of view, which is a really important distinction, right? Like there were lots of security tools, but not very many developer security tools. And so we, you know, I actually, like I hit a wall at some point where I was like, there is just nothing available. And I reached out to a Slack community that I'm a part of. And I just asked, you know, has anyone done this, right? What are people doing? What was quite interesting to me at the time was that like we seemed to be reasonably speaking on the forefront of this sort of stuff, right? No one had really started doing this in earnest. And so there wasn't a huge product evaluation. Sorry, there wasn't a huge set of products available, right? The market was quite small. And so someone just chimed in to be like, yeah, look, we just put in Nucleus. And, you know, we really like it. And what was really the cincher for me was, and the pricing doesn't suck. Because, yeah. You know, there were products, right? There totally were products. And there was, you know, one particular product that was kind of like the best in the market, but they were so unrealistically expensive, so above what you could, like, even for an enterprise, right, could realistically pay.
They just priced themselves out of the thing. So there was, So there was one other good one, but it was just, forget it, expensive.
Right, exactly. And I mean, we were a little bit worried that due to some of their negotiating tactics, that they just weren't really going to hold to what they said, basically.
So you were worried they were going to sell you on a cheap license in year one and then jack up the prices?
Basically, yes.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And so, yeah.
So, like, let's just talk more about the rationale, because a lot of people would know Nucleus is aggregating a lot of, you know, output from tools like Nessus and, you know, Qualys and whatever. So more on that sort of operation side. But you're talking about this really from a developer-centric point of view. What sort of information were you trying to aggregate and then curate for developers?
So we were essentially trying to give developers a view of all of their kind of quote unquote assets, right? So from a dev point of view, that's really source code repositories and code vulnerabilities within those source code repositories. So we used Sneak for SCA and we used Checkmarks for SAST, and they were good from their perspective. But like the thing about every vulnerability source tool is that they don't really show things in a particularly nice way, not in a kind of comprehensive way. They don't give you any way to like triage and raise.
Yeah, there's no workflow. Like, what do you mean?
There's no workflow, right? Like, it's just like, here's a vulnerability, right? These tools are amazing at finding vulnerabilities, but they frankly suck at everything else.
Yeah.
Right? And so the idea was, we want to like pull this all into one place, just expose this to developers. We'll start reporting to them monthly. And this is kind of part of our broader transformation was, all right, so we did monthly reporting to them. We gave them a view of what their coverage is and what their vulnerabilities were in an effort to kind of give them more tools to both prioritize within their own work, but also take this data, almost like weaponized data, to their product managers and be able to say, hey, this is stuff that we need to do, which is not to say that product managers weren't interested.
No, but it's always nice to be able to actually show them rather than waving your hands about and saying, we have a problem. You can say, well, here's a list of our problems, right? Very specific.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So they had data that they could use to do that. And so, you know, the kind of the value add there was, well, we're a tiny AppSec team, right? Like we were a team of that at that point, like 3 or 4, which, you know, might sound big for some organizations, but certainly when you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of developers, it's still quite small. And we were able to slowly over time, over the course of 9 months, 9 to 12 months, kind of create this change where after a while, devs were just self-serving, right?
There
was
this was going to be my next question, which is by providing them just with that information that they otherwise would just be oblivious to, right? Because probably another security person, as you said, the AppSec team's probably the one, you know, normally collecting that information and then having to send an email to this developer saying, hey, you might want to fix this and that sort of thing, right?
Right.
So by plumbing all of this information through to them, like how much of the problem of code bugs did it actually, or, you know, recognizable code bugs that it actually solve?
So what was really cool about this is that we tried not to go and retroactively fix code bugs so much as have these tools embedded so early in the pipeline and have this feedback so early in the pipeline. They were just kind of keeping everything up to date as they were going. So particularly, and we were really successful, particularly around the SCA point of view, where like SCA is a sort of game where every day a new vulnerability comes out, right? It's too much data to sift through to identify whether there are real vulnerabilities. Frankly, like it's just not a problem that you can solve without throwing a stupid amount of resources at it. And so what we ended up seeing is we'd aggregate into the central point of view, they'd get a view of everything, and then they'd just be like, okay, cool, we're building a new feature, right? We're gonna touch this microservice. We're just gonna upgrade everything. We're just gonna address everything. Right. And they'd build in time, they'd bake time into their sprint, they'd bake time into their feature so that at the beginning of everything, they were just fixing everything. And so, I mean, from my point of view, that was a huge success because we went from, you know, features and microservices not really having been touched from a security perspective in a huge way. I mean, they were definitely doing patching and things, but in a huge kind of like thinking about it proactively way, for, you know, maybe 6 to 12 months to, all right, we're touching this thing, everything's going to be the latest version. And the real benefit there is that every time they go and touch it, they have to do a little bit less and a little bit less and a little bit less until it just became part of their workflow. So they were really, I mean, they became proactive security people, and it kind of transferred and federated out the security ownership away from this kind of core tiny team, which was like had only so much bandwidth to it being, well, this is a shared problem, right? This is a shared ownership, and everyone is responsible for fixing this.
I mean, it sounds like, you know, you've transformed everyone into, you know, great little worker bees who are going along and just fixing things. And like, I'm not trying to say that in a patronizing way, but it's like, it just sounds like, you know, people were able to sort of use this as part of their day-to-day and just like repair things instead of continuously opening new wounds. You know?
Well, that, yeah, there's a little bit of that. I mean, I've always kind of come from the perspective where I don't own security, right? Like I never, as a manager and as a team, we never owned security. We informed, we helped, but frankly, these are teams. And, you know, in a modern kind of scaled agile organization where you've got long running teams, like these teams are responsible for their assets, right? They're responsible for their services. That's like one of the core tenets of DevOps. You put all these people together, a long running team, and this team is responsible for watering it, maintaining it, building. Why aren't they responsible for security? Well, they are, right? Like that's the reality is they are. And so we were really just giving them the tools to be able to take their ownership, their DevOps mindset, and turn that into a DevSecOps mindset, right?
Yeah.
So
I mean, like having this stuff all plumbed through to Slack and whatever, it's pretty nice as well, right? Like it's a contemporary solution is what I'm getting at.
It is a contemporary solution. I think in a lot of organizations,
you know, it doesn't export to Excel. I'm sure it does, but that's probably not how people use it.
So you can, right? I think the thing about Nucleus is that we try and make it as flexible as possible. And this is another kind of core tenet of who we are is that, and certainly what I'm experiencing now that I'm on the other side, right, is that every organization has a different view of vulnerability management.
Well, I was going to actually ask you that. Like, first of all, we should point out that, yeah, you'd liked Nucleus so much that you now work there after a 3-year stint at your previous employer that we're talking about, the large logistics organization. You now work for Nucleus and you're like the APAC guy for Nucleus. I'm curious to know, like, since you've gone to work for a vendor that you used in a certain way, like, how are people actually using it? Is it mostly on the AppSec side, or are people using it for that sort of compliance scanning side of things as well? Or like, what's the big use case, and what are the surprises that what are the surprises that you've had since you switched over?
So that's an interesting question, right? Like, what are people using it for? And the reality of the answer is that our customers are actually using it for completely different things, right? And they're all converging in the same direction, which is using it for literally everything. So, I mean, this is kind of a key part of the market that's missing, right? Where you've got competitors which are focused on infra, you've got competitors that are focused on compliance or just on AppSec. Our customers are realizing that, okay, well, they started with infra or they started with AppSec. Right, generally it's one of the two.
But once you've got it, why not?
Once you've got it, you're like, oh, you've got this other functionality, and we can actually pull the compliance information next to the AppSec information, next to the infra information. And so what we're seeing is that we have a lot of customers that start out using just one functionality, and then they're like, there's so much value here, we now want to centralize everything and have a complete view and report on everything and provide this information to the relevant teams as well to act on it.
I mean, I kind of categorize Nucleus as being sort of, you know, security management software, right? Like it is, you know, it's not really a technical solution. There's a lot of technology that goes into it, but ultimately it's workflow software.
It's a workflow solution. Yeah. It's a workflow solution. And the other thing that's really interesting about this is that in order to solve vulnerability management, right, like, you think of that, when you talk about that topic, you're thinking really about vulnerabilities, right? But really a big part of what we're now beginning to solve on a huger scale is actually asset management, right? Most organizations, in fact, I have never met an organization that has a CMDB that anyone is ever proud of, right?
No.
No one ever talks about having a great asset management team and having a great asset management capability. And so this is a thing that's kind of like in a lot of organizations, people manually go and update records and they have patchy data here and there. But to do vulnerability management, like, you're not doing it unless you know that you've got coverage over everything or close to everything.
Well, I mean, you're still not going to get, even if you're using Nucleus, yeah, you're probably going to see a lot more. But I mean, your visibility is only going to be as good as the tools that you used and how they're configured, right? So, I mean, I agree with you. It's going to get you to a better place, but it's not, that's a bigger problem than you can solve. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, I mean, yes and no, right? So like the trick is to pull in the right data and to show the right information and to make it as easy as possible, right? One of the biggest fallouts, or I guess one of the biggest problems with asset management today is that most tools make it really, really difficult to get the source data and then keep it up to date. And then there's no real great way of displaying that. And a lot of the systems that own that data are really clunky, you know, the ITSM-based products. They're really difficult to kind of move in an agile way. And when you're talking about cloud, the speed of cloud and the speed of DevOps, like you need to be able to be really, really quick with the changing landscape with the new tools.
Are you focused on internal or external assets or both?
Both.
Do you have a Rumble integration as well?
We have a Rumble integration. We're coming out with an asset owner integration very, very soon.
Yeah.
But that's it, right? Like where the intention here is to be the source of data for everything, right?
Yeah, plug it all in. Doesn't matter. Asset discovery, vuln scanning.
Right, right.
Well, Gil Azaria, thank you so much for joining us on the show to talk about your experiences first being a customer of Nucleus and now being its APAC manager. It's been a great chat, man. Really interesting stuff. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Gil Azaria of Nucleus Security there. You can check them out at nucleussec.com. That's NucleusSec.com. That's actually it for this week's show. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.